Hello and welcome to The Housing Platform, a podcast brought to you by Platform Housing Group. My name is Richard Hurst. I'm a communications business partner, and this month we're bringing you a special podcast off the back of National Stalking Awareness Week, which took place at the end of April. Now, as the week approached, we put a call out to colleagues asking if they had experienced stalking or knew someone who had. And a lady called Joanna Selby, who's one of our customer engagement officers, bravely answered the call. The statistics around stalking are quite scary. One in three women and one in six men have been stalked at some point in their lives. And whilst most stalking is committed by someone known to the victim, such as an ex-partner or acquaintance, some victims are stalked by complete strangers. 50% of victims have curtailed or stopped work due to stalking. 75% of domestic violence stalkers will turn up at the workplace. And 79% of domestic violence stalkers will use work resources to target their victims. About 45% of people are being stalked by ex-partners, and a further third have had some sort of prior acquaintance with their stalker. Maybe have dated, married, or been a friend with them. Joanna herself was stalked for 2.5 years and wanted to share her experience as a way to help others. So in this podcast, you're going to hear her story. Now, a trigger warning about this. The story is about someone who has survived stalking, which is a form of domestic abuse. And there will be detail about the experience endured. So please only continue listening if you're comfortable with that. So here's what happened when I sat down and chatted with Jo.
I'm Joanna Selby, and I'm a customer engagement officer at Platform Housing.
Cool, thank you. Why is telling your story so important to you?
I think the primary importance for me is to let other people know that you can survive. I don't think it's about going, look what a terrible time I had, and you need to feel sorry for me. I don't feel sorry for me. I'm not a victim, I'm a survivor, and I think people go through all kinds of different things, and people suffer through all kinds of difficulties, and they don't ask for help. And that's something like Stalking Awareness Week that says, hey, look at all this hell. Mm-hmm. And hey, look, these people survived. That's why it's important. It's not about me. It's about if you're suffering, you don't have to. Mm-hmm. There's help. So for me, that's why it's important, really.
Now, for anyone who's read your story so far, they'll know that yours was, your experience was a while ago.
Yeah.
But can I just ask how you're kind of coping looking back at the experience?
It's quite strange. It wasn't triggering because I've done a lot of work to kind of get through and get past all of that. But I think kind of reading it written down, it felt quite strange that it was almost like it happened to somebody else. Mm. And I think kind of since writing it, other bits and pieces of kind of, I remembered that bit. But it's not been kind of difficult. I think the biggest thing reflecting on looking back on it is how different it is now, how much better it is now, how most of the things that happened to me, it wouldn't go on for 2.5 years now like it did with me. So I think I can reflect on that and go, that's positive, that's mm-hmm. moving forward, mm-hmm. you know, as much as mine was horrible.
So, yeah, how long ago was it then?
Oh, it's over 20 years, probably. Let me think. It started in maybe 2001, so it's a very long time ago. Yeah.
And where did it all start? Where do you, now that you're looking back at it and you can tell the story, where did it all start?
I think, like, I was with this guy and he seemed okay, and it was, you know, there wasn't a single red flag. It was really strange. And then when we moved in together, and it was like a light switch moment where he was like, well, you know, you're a minute late back from work, and why are you doing this? And what do you want to go out with? I had a male friend. What do you want to go out with him for? Because I had done. And I still go out with him now, even though he's married now. Hmm. But it was those kinds of things, and it just felt, it was literally coming back every day going, where were you? Who have you been? Who have you spoken to? That kind of stuff. And that just, it felt very controlling. So I just came home from work one day and he started, and I went, look, it's over, you just need to leave. Mm. So we moved out that night, and I don't know if it was an ego thing or whatever, but it started immediately the next day. Mm. From kind of, you leave, yeah, boom, straight away he was back. It's weird.
But I guess you never really thought it would turn into what it did.
No, and the interesting thing was that when I was with him, he had an older sister who'd separated from her child's father and had stalked him for 9 years and smashed up his car, threw paint in his house. And she was horrendous. And he constantly criticised her and constantly said, I'm so ashamed. Why is she doing that? What's the matter with her? Can you talk to her? So the fact that he was so kind of, oh, God, that's really shocking that somebody would do that, never gave me the slightest inkling that he would do exactly the same. That was the most bizarre thing. Yeah.
So what after he'd moved out, you said it kind of almost started straight away from that point. What was the first red flag for you?
So I went into work the next day and this huge, very expensive bouquet of flowers rocked up from him. And it's like, okay. You know, everybody in the office, I was in a housing office and everybody was like, oh, exciting. I was like, no, I don't want them. We've split up, whatever. And they were going, well, we'll just take them home and enjoy them. And we had a tenant who's a really nice tenant whose husband had died about 10 days before. And I said, take the card out and just drop them around her house. So that was that. And then he was phoning the office to speak to me. And when I went out to the car park, he was waiting to speak to me. And I said, but I don't want to speak to you. Leave me alone. Da, 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 da. Again, I thought it was fine. You know, I was very clear.
Yeah.
It's over.
It's over.
I don't want to see you.
And sometimes I suppose those kind of behaviours at the start can feel like just a natural part of the separation process. If one person wants separation, the other person doesn't. Not natural. No, not natural. But I suppose a given sometimes if someone isn't happy with the way a separation's gone, that behaviour, I don't know.
That's possible.
I'm potentially trying to excuse it.
That's possible. I don't get that. If somebody doesn't want you, they don't want you. So you have to lick your wounds and heal your bruised ego. Why go back to be hurt more when you're already hurt? I'm not that kind of person that's kind of jealous or vengeful of anything like that. You don't want me? Fine. Your loss, not mine. Move on. So it's possible that was what was going on with him, but I can't process that because my brain doesn't work that way.
And obviously, you know, we know now that it went beyond just that kind of behaviour into a long period. So how did things progress and get worse?
So I came into work the next day and there were 200 emails that he'd sent overnight to my work email account. And I panicked. I'm a conscientious person and we weren't supposed to get personal emails into work. Same as here, you know, if it's an emergency or whatever, you've got a bit of latitude. But this was 200 emails that came into work. So I kind of said, oh, God, you know. And I went in to see the housing manager and I said, he sent 200 emails. And I haven't asked for them. I haven't given my email. You know, I was flapping and kind of panicking. And she said, OK, we'll call IT. So we spoke to somebody in IT. And I said, I haven't asked for these. I don't want to get into trouble. Da, da, da. I said, can you just delete them? And I don't want to see them. If they come in, I'll delete them. And she went, what we'll do is we'll make sure you don't see them, but I'll hang on to them just in case. So day one, straight away, that was like, right, we're going to look at them and all the rest of it. So then I went out at the end of the day and he's waiting out by the car. So luckily I wasn't the last one out of the office. So I went back in the office and said, he's waiting out by the car. What do I do? So we had this huge, great, kind of 6'5" rent officer. And he said, I'll come out to the car with you. You know, there were lots of people kind of ready to look after me. Because he wasn't right next to my car. He was kind of parked nearby. So he took me and saw me to my car. And then I kind of just went off and all the rest of it. And then every day, my understanding is every day emails were coming through. He would often wait out, pretty much every other day, wait outside the office. He was sending flowers all of the time to the office. I mean, it reached the point where people were coming to my house in the morning to like convoying to work, to get into work, and then convoying me home because he was there all the time. The thing was, he had a unique car. He had a Japanese import Nissan Skyline, and it was the only one in Coventry. So it's not like it wasn't in a, you know, if you're in a Peugeot, good luck finding that in Coventry. But it wasn't. It was so unique that he was just everywhere. So he'd be constantly driving around the house. He called the landline and tied the landline up. So then he'd call my mobile and tie the mobile up. So I had to get another mobile. My sister bought me another mobile. So that just in case anything happened to the kids in the middle of the night, then I had kind of a safety measure. So I called the police and they weren't particularly responsive. So again, the housing, because we worked in housing and we had a relationship with the local police, the housing manager invited the local police and team in for a meeting about, we worked in quite a challenging estate. So she invited them in for a meeting about kind of ASB on the estate, and then got them in her office, shut the door and said, right, take notes. So, you know, that was, so they were straight away, there were, all that support was there from kind of work.
And how has this changed the way you're able to live your life or not?
I mean, I was terrified the whole time. He you know, put letters through the door, you know, threatening letters saying, you know, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to slit you from neck to navel, I'm going to cut your throat, I'm going to blind your kids, I'm going to cripple your kids, I'm going to burn your house down with your kids in it, I'm going to attack the kids at school. It was just threat after threat after threat. To the point that I stopped reading them, but there were letters coming through pretty much every day. He was at the school all the time, and every time he phoned the police, they'd say, yeah, we'll talk to him. And I never had any feedback, and I never had any support from victim support. So I would just be stuck in this thing. And I think, to be honest, I did reach a point where it was like, this is going to be my life now, where I'm just terrified. I can't sleep because I'm terrified that he'll burn my house down or he'll hurt my kids. It was rough.
Yeah.
It was rough.
And obviously there comes a point with everybody. What was the tipping point for you where you kind of had to say, I suppose, no more? Or
so in 2003, I got a job as a customer involvement officer. And so I'm kind of getting ready to make the transition. And I'm thinking, you know, this is a new start. And I need a new start across the board, really. Mm. And it got particularly busy. It was daily flowers. There were letters coming to the office, housing office now. So I was visiting a block of flats, and there was a police station directly opposite. And I thought, right, I'm here anyway. It's lunchtime. I'll go in my lunch hour and just say, look, can you help me? So I went in, and it was a civilian on the reception. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, you know, this is going on. It's been going on for a really long time. Can somebody help me? And she said, oh, it's just a domestic. And that was the attitude in that time. And I kind of lost it. I'd recently, about 4 months before, we'd done some training on the new anti-harassment legislation, which said that anything that was likely to cause harm, harm, alarm or distress was actionable by the police, and you needed 3 instances of it to action it. So that had literally just come in, and we had like corporate training like we get here. So that I'm spouting this because I've been on this training. It's harassment. He's causing me harm, alarm and distress. And I never lose my temper and I never shout, but I got really kind of agitated, and I was in effect screaming in the police station, go, you've got to help me. What do I do? So a police sergeant just was walking past and went, all right, love, what's going on? So I just kind of sobbing inconsolably, between sobs, he kind of understood what was going on, and I explained the situation and, you know, how bad it was. And he said, okay, well, I'll come and do a statement. So I said, okay, this is my address, da da da. So he said, I'll be there tonight. So he didn't come. So I thought, oh, you know, maybe whatever. So then the next day he didn't come. So I drove down to the police station and said, this guy said he was coming, da da da. And they said, oh no, we'll get him to call you. So he called and he said, I'm really sorry, we had a murder. So I got pulled onto that and I couldn't come. So then the next, he said, I'll come tonight. So then he didn't come tonight, that night. So again, he did phone me the next day and he said, I'm really sorry, we were coming to yours, but at the time there was a pub at the end of my street. We got called to an altercation at the end of the street. But while we were there, we saw his car circle your house multiple times. So it kind of, that kind of, because I felt believed, I think, really. So then the next night, it was my leaving do. So we were doing my leaving do. Luckily, I'm not a boozer, so we were only going for dinner. So he said, I'll come tomorrow. And I said, oh, it's my leaving do. So he said, OK, I'll come after that. I'll come to yours at 9 o'clock. I'm on a late, so it's fine. So 9 o'clock came, 10 o'clock came, 11 o'clock came. Didn't see sound or sound of him. Then the door knocked at 10 past 11. So I'm obviously, because I think, is it my stalker? Whatever. So I went upstairs and looked out the window. It was a policeman. And he came in, he said, I'm really, really sorry. My shift is finished, but I've let you down so many times. Let me take the statement. So he came in and took the statement till it was about 4:30 in the morning. He just was writing stuff and very sympathetic and really supportive. And he kind of said, you know, what do you need to happen? I said, you've had him in cautioned multiple times. You've had him into the police station multiple times and it's made no difference. If you go to his mum and dad's house where he's living and they see what's happening, they will tell him to put his head on back on straight. He loves his dad. You know, he will listen to him. So so that was that. Didn't hear anything, didn't get any update. But my friend across the road, who'd witnessed all of it, was in a bar about 4 or 5 weeks later. And he came over and said, oh, do you hear what Joanna did? She, you know, she got me arrested. She made up all these lies about me. They dragged me out of my mum and dad's house at 5:30 in the morning in my boxer shorts. It was so embarrassing. She's an effing liar. Da, 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 da. And she was just like, she didn't say anything because she wanted to see what else he had to say. But in her mind, she knew you're deluded. But yeah, so they gave him, and I never heard from him ever again. That was it. Wow. I bumped into him at the Godiva Festival about 10 years ago. And he had a baby in a buggy and a toddler by the side of him. And we came face to face, like 24 inches away from each other, and did eye contact. And I looked straight at him. And in my head, I'm like, I'm not moving. Because we were, you know, straight in front of each other. And I just looked at him and thought, you move. You move. And he did. He put his head down. I'd like to think because he was embarrassed, but I don't know. And kind of walked away. Yeah. And I felt, that felt really good. That felt like, you've not beaten me. You have not beaten me. I think that's, you know, it's probably my saving grace is my stubbornness. You are not going to beat me.
I mean, looking, obviously, you know, you're able to look back at it. And as you said, right at the start, that idea of survival has been so key, I guess, along the way. Is that the main way you reflect on the experience now that you went through it but survived?
Yeah, and I think it's there's no such thing as a completely irreparable situation. I'm a strong believer in that. There's always something positive you can get from it, something you can learn. So whether you learn about yourself, yes, I can survive. You learn about how strong you can be. But also for me, because I've got two sons, then I've thought, okay, how did that feel for me? And I wanted to take the opportunity to teach my sons to be the best version of themselves that they could be. So thinking about how they interact with women, how they're both straight, but you know, how they interact with women, how they treat their partners, what they need to do. And also that kind of sense of saying, if somebody doesn't want you, they don't want you, say thank you very much, bye-bye. So, you know, I had an opportunity to educate them, and touch wood, you know, they turned into sons I'm very proud of.
Good. And what do you think your career in housing, how do you think that helped, aided, you know, played alongside all of this that was going on at the same time?
I think the beauty of people in housing, and because I've worked in two landlords, so I've come across lots of colleagues in lots of different iterations of and roles in housing. I think the key thing about people that work in housing is that they are compassionate, they have empathy, and they want to kind of solve problems, really. And I think it was that thing of, you know, they'd seen other people suffering domestic abuse, because at that time it would have come under the domestic abuse umbrella, but they knew about supporting people and supporting customers, and it was just they turned it on me, and they absolutely had my back. Every single member of that office were looking at, and somebody wasn't, IT, what the hell do they have to do with customers? But straight away she was like, right, we're going to save this for evidence. And just that having your back and looking after each other. And again, I think that's something that's quite unique to housing, that we look after each other. We sometimes drive each other mad. Sometimes, you know, we have the natural frustrations that you have in any workplace, but we take care of each other. And, you know, certainly that was the case there. And I don't see anything to the contrary here at Platform
and it's a really good example, actually, just what you say there about the IT team, about, you know, you never know when your role will become important to something that at the time doesn't feel like it's anything to do with what your day-to-day job is.
It's so isolating when you're in that situation, because I was a single mum with two kids and I couldn't put it on the kids. And I didn't tell my family too much about it because I didn't want to cause them any worry or stress. So it was just me dealing with that. But the fact that I had, you know, when I went to work every day, I had a room full of people who were like a shield of protection almost around me. If I hadn't had them, I don't know whether I'd have survived, genuinely. I know that sounds a bit dramatic, but just having that support, having that, you know, we believe in you, we trust you, we'll look after you, we'll care for you. You know, I'm so grateful for that because I don't know. You know, I had when I got up in the morning, I could get to work. The kids were in school, so they were safe. I could go to work and feel safe.
Yeah.
So it was like an oasis of almost calm, even though I had work to do and still customers coming in ranting about my gas isn't working and why have you sent me this rent arrears letter? You know, all of that still happened. But I could do my job, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. And finally, what's your message to anyone suffering or suspecting that stalking might be something that's happening to them?
I think the first thing you need to tell yourself is it's not you didn't do it, it's them. The fault is absolutely with them. I think there's no need to be embarrassed because it's not you that has that problem. And I think help got me through, and asking for help, there's no shame, there's no stigma, there's no embarrassment. Asking for help with people who deal with this every day or have the expertise to help you navigate through,
yeah.
Is absolutely essential. When you're in it and feeling emotional and like a ball bearing in a pinball machine, somebody who's outside it, somebody who works for someone like Susie Lamplew or the police or whatever, whichever support agency you go to, they are a bit more impartial, they can be a bit more level-headed and logical, mm-hmm. and when you can't be.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Good point.
So, and I think just get help. Mm-hmm. Just get help. And if you are suffering it at the moment, that, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel might seem really, really far away, but if you get help, that light gets bigger and bigger and bigger and you come out the tunnel at the other end. Mm-hmm. So that's how really cheesy.
Not at all. Jo, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So everyone here at Platform wants to say a huge heartfelt thank you to Joanna for very bravely coming forward and telling her story, which is incredibly hard to do. Her strength is a real example to all of us. As she said, if you or someone you know has experienced something similar, please reach out, look in the direction of getting help, either at your workplace or with a support organisation like the Susie Lamplew Trust, and that's spelt Lamplugh. Thank you very much for listening. Remember to contact us about anything you hear on our podcasts. Our email is podcasts@platformhg.com. Till next time, take care and we'll see you soon.